This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. With the holiday season upon us, our top story this podcast focuses on the many potential employment law issues that can arise from workplace holiday parties. This can be an especially joyous time of the year, but it also presents the risk of some legal hangovers that can stick around long after the celebration is over. Fortunately, we have a longtime employment attorney joining us today to discuss these issues and what you can do to avoid them and ensure your office party does not go bust. Robin Shea practices with Constangi, Brooks & Smith in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where she represents employers. Robin, it's great to have you with us again.
Well, thank you, David.
And Robin also, I should mention, authors her firm's Employment and Labor Insider blog and conducts training for HR professionals, management, and employees on a host of topics. So we'll address some other hot employment law issues as well later on. But perhaps nothing is timelier than office holiday parties. Robin, while it may be the season to be jolly, from your perspective, do these workplace parties present more risks than benefits for employers?
Well, I'd hate to say that they are more risky than beneficial for employers, but there are definitely some risks that employers need to be aware of. Of course, the camaraderie of having a holiday party is great. It's a nice time for everybody to get together and not be worried about work. But on the other hand, on the more negative side, employers have to be concerned about harassment liability that could come up based on partiers who get a little carried away with their behavior, possible liability for drunken driving if somebody leaves the party and doesn't have a designated driver, and not necessarily liability, but employers need to be sensitive to the feelings of all employees of other religious faiths and who may have dietary restrictions that aren't consistent with what you would expect at a holiday party.
Now, to keep costs down, many employers have done away altogether with including spouses or dates at these parties. Is that a mistake, or can it be a mistake in your eyes?
Well, I sympathize with the cost concern, but I do think it's a mistake not to invite spouses or significant others, just because that's a very nice, natural, unheavy-handed way to put some controls on employees' behavior at these parties. For example, the office Romeo is probably a lot less likely to act like a Romeo if his wife is there with him. So I do think it's a good idea to invite spouses and dates or friends even of the employees if possible. I realize that isn't necessarily affordable for all employers, but it is a good way to keep behavior under control.
With that said, certainly it sounds exciting to have a big party, but is a luncheon the safest way to go to avoid some of these problems becoming tomorrow's harassment lawsuit?
I hate to sound like such a killjoy. I do think a luncheon is probably a safer bet than an evening party, just because people tend not to drink as much. I think there's less of a partying atmosphere at a luncheon. And even if they do drink alcohol, they're probably not going to be drinking it in the quantities they might be drinking in the evening. So I do think that is a little bit safer, but I would hate to tell any employer to just go to a lunch.
Any other big mistakes that you see employers or HR making in this area when it comes to planning for their holiday parties?
I think the biggest mistake that employers, whether it's members of management or HR, make in response to these parties is no matter what somebody may do at a holiday party, the reaction tends to be, well, it was just a party, you know, so-and-so had a little too much to drink, and yeah, they shouldn't have done what they did, but it was a party. And I think employers need to take bad behavior at any kind of office party more seriously than they frequently do in reality.
Well, in terms of taking things more seriously, Robin, should there be any sort of special training for supervisors on how to handle any situations that might perhaps arise?
I think it's a good idea to include in any harassment training the possibility that a harassment claim could arise as a result of behavior at a party, and especially behavior by somebody who had too much to drink. I always cover that in my standard harassment training, in that being drunk at the party is not an excuse for bad behavior. As far as other issues associated with office parties, like drunk driving and designated drivers and that kind of thing, I think that is good to probably remind everybody of immediately before the party. As far as a harassment warning, I'm not sure anybody would pay attention to that, so I think it's better to just cover that as part of the general training that goes on for management throughout the year. And then the other thing is, I think employers just need to kind of keep an eye on the way employees behave during the party. And if they see any potential trouble going on, kind of politely and tactfully intervene before it gets out of hand, including if you see two employees wander off together by themselves.
Now, regarding harassment, if a complaint is made against a company stemming from a holiday party where the supervisors were present, who should investigate that complaint?
We would normally recommend that human resources, or if the company has in-house employment counsel, that somebody in that capacity conduct the investigation. Now, it's possible that the HR and legal people were also at the party, and in that case, depending on how serious the allegation is, the company might want to consider bringing in a third party to conduct the investigation. On the other hand, if it's relatively minor or it's pretty much undisputed behavior, like somebody got drunk and told an off-color joke, you probably don't need a huge mega investigation. HR or legal, even if they were at the party, can probably determine what the appropriate remedy for that should be.
Well, we've certainly gone through the don'ts of what employers should not do, but I don't want to be a complete killjoy here. So what about the do's when it comes to employer holiday parties?
We would recommend that employers do take some steps to monitor and limit the use of alcohol at parties and make sure they do have arrangements made. If it's an evening party, they have hotel rooms available for people so they can spend the night if they don't feel safe to drive home, or that they have designated drivers who can take people home so they get home safely. Employers need to be welcoming to everybody, whether they call it a Christmas party or a holiday party or winter party, whatever they're going to call it, that they make sure that all employees understand they're all welcome and that it's a party for everybody. And then the other piece of advice I would give to employers is do keep your eyes open for any potential trouble. You know, either people getting into a heated argument after they'd had too much to drink, two people wandering off by themselves, which could end up with some type of severe harassment allegation the next day, anything like that, and certainly people who are intoxicated and trying to drive home. The employer should intervene that evening.
Again, we're speaking with North Carolina employment attorney Robin Shea of Constangi Brooks and Smith. This is certainly an intriguing topic, talking about holiday parties, but Robin is one of the nation's foremost employment bloggers as well, so I'd be remiss if we didn't spend some time on a few other notable issues. At the end of the year is always a time to kind of take stock of things, and many companies are undoubtedly doing just that. So with that said, Robin, what's the top trend you see out there to watch affecting the employment law landscape potentially in 2014?
Well, several things. Certainly the Supreme Court same-sex marriage decision was huge, and we just saw the Employment Non-Discrimination Act at least make it through the Senate. Whether it's going to make it any farther than that, we don't know, and that looks questionable, but it's gone farther than it ever has before. That will be a big area to keep an eye on. The Affordable Care Act obviously is huge right now and will continue to be as we see whether the government can get their website up and running and whether people are going to be able to sign up for insurance or not, and what's going to happen with the bill that might allow people to continue with their current insurance policies. The NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is cranking back up now that President Obama has a full board in place. So we will probably continue to see decisions coming down from the NLRB that A, are valid, and B, greatly expand the rights of employees in the workplace. And then another issue that I think is becoming really hot right now is whether employers need to make reasonable accommodations to employees who are pregnant. New York City just recently passed an ordinance or an amendment to the human rights law requiring employers to make certain reasonable accommodations to pregnant employees, and that seems to be a growing trend nationwide, and there's been quite a bit of agitation to change the federal law in that regard, and a lot of activity at the state levels and even some municipal levels like New York City. Because currently, employers are not allowed to discriminate against pregnant employees, but they generally don't have to make reasonable accommodations to pregnancy-related conditions.
Now, would those changes you're talking about involve adjustments to the Family and Medical Leave Act, or are we talking about something else entirely?
It would probably come in the form of an amendment to Title VII, which prohibits discrimination based on a number of characteristics, including sex, and that also covers pregnancy-related conditions. So Title VII would have to be amended to not just prohibit discrimination, but also to require reasonable accommodation for pregnancy.
Robin, it's been nearly 5 years since the landmark Lilly Ledbetter law came into being, allowing female employees to go back many years if they need to cite alleged discriminatory acts, if those actions led to them being paid less than their male colleagues for doing the same work. This is a law that you've written about in your blog. How much has it affected the employment litigation landscape from what you've seen?
I would have to say hardly at all. The impact seems to have been pretty minimal. We were concerned when that law was first enacted that it would apply to any employment decision that could affect somebody's pay, including a failure to promote somebody into a position for an allegedly discriminatory reason. And as the courts have interpreted that, it doesn't apply that way. It applies only to pay decisions. And so given that, the effect has not been dramatic at all. It does expand the period of time for which somebody can recover damages if they show that they were paid unequally based on their sex or race or other characteristic. But apart from that, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, I don't think, anything that I've seen.
I covered that case at the Supreme Court and the ensuing legislation, and there was a lot of the sky is falling from employers right after that. But it sounds like from what you're saying, HR can breathe a sigh of relief.
Yeah, and I've got to put myself in the category of thinking the sky was going to be falling, because that's what I thought at the time. But it was because I think employers and a lot of their lawyers, including me, thought it was going to be viewed very expansively to cover any employment decision that might affect somebody's pay.
More in the trenches, Robin, I'm curious to find out, what's the biggest question that you've been fielding from employers these days?
The biggest ones I've had have still been dealing with the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Family and Medical Leave Act and how those two work together with employees who've been out on leave. They might have exhausted their FMLA time, but the employer is still concerned about its reasonable accommodation obligations under the ADA. That still seems to be number one.
That always seems to be a big issue as to how the ADA and the FMLA and even workmen's compensation law interacts with that. Any changes you see that can make that a little bit easier going forward?
I'm not aware of any changes on the horizon in that area, so I think the calls will keep on coming.
Okay. Well, that will let that be the last word. Robin Shea of Constanji Brooks & Smith has been my guest, and if you'd like to hear more about issues surrounding office holiday parties, Robin will be presenting a webinar on that very topic for Expert HR in the coming weeks. Robin, it's been great speaking with you. We appreciate the insights.
Thanks for having me, David.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this ExpertHR.com podcast. Thanks again for listening. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on key employment law topics affecting the world of HR. Recent programs include social media issues affecting the workplace, plus a look at what OFCCP rule changes may mean for federal contractors. The opinions expressed on this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR and our subscription offering, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. And if you mention listening to this podcast, we'll give you 20% off a new subscription. Copyright 2013, all rights reserved.